Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode, latest edition, latest chapter, latest offering from Life on Planet Porky. And it's a big welcome from me and a big welcome from Miss Jones.
Buongiorno. How are we doing?
Pretty well indeed. Thank you very much indeed. I'm taken in by that fantastic, you just said buongiorno there. I know that's not French, but...
Well, it was kind of a mixture of French and Italian, yeah. Wasn't it? It came out a bit wrong, but you know the sentiment is there.
Of course I do, of course I do. And I'm watching Emily in Paris at the moment. It's just so funny, honestly. I think it's fantastic. I absolutely love it.
You know why French women are so skinny, don't you?
No.
Well, it's all that shrugging they do. So, you know, all the mais oui, mais non, mais oui, mais non, every sort of little thing they utter is accompanied by a shrug of the shoulders.
Yeah, well,
and it's the reason they stay thin.
When I heard the syllable shh, I thought you were going to say it's all that shagging they do. But
I thought it was going to be something else.
Anyway, so.
Family show.
Family show, that's right, yeah. But I got a text from somebody last week saying, stop saying it's a family show. We've got the idea.
Somebody rang me. This is absolutely true. A friend rang me on Saturday night.
Yeah.
And he said... I've perfected my Mike Parry impersonation.
Really?
And he did your whole intro of Pat and then rounded it off with Family Show. It was brilliant.
Oh, good. I'm very pleased about that.
You know you've made it when,
you know. Absolutely, yeah, when people start imitating you. Listen, just first things first, did you ever come across Frank Boff?
Well, I did because my father worked with him on Grandstand for a number of years. Yeah. He was quite a sort of imperious guy, wasn't he? I was always a bit scared of him. He used to come round to parties and things at home.
Really?
But then he got kind of outed in this big sex and drug scandal, didn't he?
I mean, listen, you mustn't talk ill of the dead, obviously. But, I mean, he
Well, we can.
Yes, we can, I suppose, yeah. But, well, it's not that we're speaking ill of the dead. We're just relating facts. And the thing is, he was a massive... personality on television. He was sort of the most famous newsreader stroke presenter face. Then all of a sudden, bang, news of the world, and he's found in a coke den where S&M prostitutes were plying their business, and it was a scandal that temporarily ended his career, but he came back courtesy of Sky.
Well, he did, yeah. But what I thought was funny about that, years later when I understood things like this, you know, he was presenting this image on television, the sort of cardiganed, avuncular, safe kind of chap.
Yes, that's right.
All of which was to throw us off the scent that he was really a shagger in a coke den.
Exactly, that's right. Absolutely, honestly. You couldn't make it up, could you? Well, you could, I suppose.
Well, the news of the world could sometimes, but they didn't on this occasion.
They didn't on this occasion, absolutely right. It's very good. Now, listen, one of the people that we talked about in the past and to whom you know very well, 84 years of age, Mr. Bill Wyman.
Oh, dear. Yes, well.
I haven't seen pictures of him lately. What's he looking like these days?
He's a bit wrinkly. He's a bit like a tortoise, you know, gone inside. I mean, the thing is, you could write a whole set of encyclopedias about Bill, couldn't you? Bill Perks from Penge as he started life. Mm. I mean, he's really, we'd have to say, the pedo who got away.
Well, yes, absolutely, because of the Mandy Jones thing, you mean?
Mandy Smith, in fact. Smith, he groomed her. I was part of his close friendship group at the time. And to my eternal shame, I stood by, watched it happen, did nothing, as did a couple of our other friends.
Yeah.
And we talk about it to this day and we say, why didn't we tell anyone? We knew what was going on. We knew because we went to her 15th birthday party.
Yeah.
That she was only 14 when he started sleeping with her. And we are ashamed of that, but we were only young ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we feel that we would have got in trouble in some way, that we might have gone to prison for it. I mean, I never even told my mother.
Mm. Golly. Yeah, amazing. The most amazing thing about him, that is amazing, obviously, the whole Mandy Smith thing was. And I remember he married her then legitimately when she was about 18, didn't he?
Yeah, it fell apart. I think the relationship was on the rocks when they got married.
Yeah, exactly.
But the funny thing that happened at that wedding was that Mick Jagger turned up with a Zimmer frame for Bill to walk up the aisle.
You're joking, really?
But Mandy was painfully thin at that stage, and she, you know, psychologically, she was just ruined by him.
Well, of course she was.
And her whole life, in fact, she's never really been able to have a normal life. Her eating disorders have followed her through life.
Yeah.
She did get married again. She married Pat Vandenhau, the goalkeeper.
Yes. No, he wasn't a goalkeeper.
No, he wasn't a goalkeeper. Fullback. Of course he wasn't.
He's fullback for Everton and Spurs.
Yeah, no, there was a goalkeeper in her life. I can't remember who that was now.
Yeah.
And then she had a son with somebody else, I think a male model.
Right.
Last heard living in Manchester, and she'd found religious faith. She was, yeah, she was counselling young female sex victims.
Oh, really?
Which, yeah. You know, sort of applying her own experiences to how to get through or to avoid this kind of thing, even.
Absolutely.
We didn't know much about this kind of stuff back then. Well, we know so much more now.
Yeah, and he got away with it because he was a Rolling Stone. That was it, full stop. Talking about religious faith, by the way, we've missed a trick here, Miss Jones, because a group of nuns have hit number one in the pop charts, albeit the classical pop charts. And, you know, if the nuns can do it, maybe we should form a group and try it. Have you ever thought about being a nun, Miss Jones?
I actually haven't, strangely enough.
Really?
No, I've never,
you
know,
you led such a, you know, a clean life and attended church every Sunday morning. I thought it might have been one of your career options when you were growing up.
I don't think it was, actually. I think I had too many other things on the go.
I think the sort of behaviour you indulged in during your sort of teenage and early 20 years prohibited you from becoming non-material, in my view, Miss Jones.
Are you trying to say I was loose?
No, not at all. But, you know, anybody who drinks 2 gallons of wine a day and frequents the sort of haunts that you used to go to with the reckless pop stars and all that kind of stuff, not exactly the life inside a nunnery.
You have evidence of this, do you?
Well, it's hearsay, isn't it?
But yeah, it's all hearsay.
It's
a very interesting thing because this album, which is called Mater Eucharistiae, has been on the Billboard Classical Traditional Albums charts for 11 weeks. Mm-hmm. And there is a precedent for this. Do you remember the Singing Nun?
I remember the title Singing Nun, but I can't picture her or why she did it.
A little bit before our time, but the Singing Nun topped the US charts in 1963 after JFK was assassinated.
Really?
And before the Beatles came along. And there is this sort of regrouping towards the spiritual in times of great adversity.
Yes.
People will sort of resort to that kind of thing en masse.
Yes.
And so the Singing Nun is at the top of the American charts, and then along come the Beatles.
Yeah.
And it's often been said that America took to the Beatles because they were an antidote to the tragedy.
Well,
and I think maybe going through a similar thing because of the pandemic. So spiritual music suddenly becomes much more comforting and important.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I tell you what, the Beatles did come along and they turned what was post-war Europe and America from black and white into colour. That's what the Beatles did. They brought light into everybody's life. But funny, you should mention that because talking about old wrinklies, Bill Wyman, 84, another great pop icon who the Beatles displaced and almost finished off is also 80 this week, and that's Cliff Richard. And I know you know so much about Cliff Richard, but what is even more interesting, the spread I saw written on Cliff Richard to celebrate his 80th birthday was written by our old Daily Express Fleet Street colleague, David Wigg.
Yes, it was a two-parter, in fact.
And, yeah.
It was the only interview that Cliff did for the press.
Yeah.
So good old Wiggy. I love Wiggy. I've known him for donkey's years, as have you. I still see him.
Mm.
You know these scribblers, pluckers, thumpers and squawkers lunches we have twice a year for all the old music business people. Wiggy always attends.
He must be 80 now, mustn't he?
Well, this is interesting. And I don't mean to offend him because I love him dearly.
Yeah.
But a few years ago, some of us, because we'd been on many press trips with David Wigg, we'd never seen his passport and we could never get hold of it. Do you remember where everyone used to be fascinated by each other's photos and dates of birth and passports? Yeah. You're always trying to get somebody's passport
name.
To have a look.
And the full names,
The full, what's their actual name, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I remember trying to get Joan Collins's passport once.
Yeah.
You know, all a bit of a laugh. But we never could get hold of Wiggy's. Mm. And this is awful. We tried to get his birth certificate.
Mm.
And it didn't exist.
Really?
So goodness knows what his real name is.
Golly. Yeah.
And goodness knows when he was born. I'd love to know.
Yeah, mystery man. I mean, he was iconic, old Wiggy in Fleet Street, because he got in with all the pop stars because he was so camp, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody loved him.
Yeah, and he has never written adverse material, let's say. So he protects the secrets. He was very close to Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, he's very good.
Freddie always gave Wiggy the exclusive interview whenever there was tour coming up, an album coming out, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he remained friends with these people. Elton John is another one of his. You know, Wiggy is good at that. The Bee Gees, people like that.
Yeah.
And look, he's still going. Whatever age he is, he's still going. God bless him.
I mean, the rumor was he had, you know, he inherited a family fortune in his 20s, bought a flat in the King's Road and never needed to work, but he just loved doing his job, didn't he?
Well, it wasn't a fortune. He's got a house down near Leeds Castle in Kent, a very old, like a 16th century cottage.
Oh, really? As well as
the which an aunt left him. I've been there. I've been there for tea. We went to a gig.
Oh, finally, yeah.
Yeah, we went to a Searchers gig, actually, because Frank Allen of the Searchers is our great mutual friend.
Right.
And Wiggy said, come down to the house and we'll have tea. And he laid on, I kid you not. Yeah. You know those... the plates that kind of are three plates on top of each other with a leg through the middle.
Bone china and all that.
Yeah. Floral. Yeah. And it was like smoked salmon sandwiches, cucumber sarnies, little Battenberg cakes, all of this kind of thing, all laid out.
Loads of wine.
Lace tablecloth. He did it all so beautifully. Yeah. God, it was very feminine, actually.
He was a bit like that. You're absolutely right about him protecting pop stars, because the only run-in I ever had with Wiggy, I was on the news desk and he'd gone to some pop star lunch, you know what I mean, an award ceremony.
And, oh, I remember this, what it was.
And he hardly ever spoke to me. He always reported back to Alan Frame, the features editor, you know what I mean? But yeah. Alan put him through to me because George Michael had got completely pissed, gone up to the microphone, I think this is the story, and started slagging people off and behaving very badly, you know? And Wiggy was so unused to having to file a live news story that he was panicking like mad and said, well, I don't think this is very fair. You know, he was very pissed and I don't think he meant it.
Yeah, that was so news reporting wasn't Wiggy's forte. Exactly. Was it? He was a feature writer. But there, I remember this. It was the Nordoff Robbins music therapy lunch.
Oh, with it? Yeah.
Which always took place every sort of late May, beginning of June. And there was another one at which Princess Michael of Kent got up.
Right.
And she gave this speech, and I think she wasn't really thinking straight.
Yeah.
But she started talking about, drugs and sex and exciting things like that. And we were all covering our eyes going, oh, my God, here we go. And then a load of us, including me, John Blake, various others, we rushed out to the bank of telephones in the foyer during the sort of comfort break. Mm. And Phil Collins wandered up. Mm-hmm. And he berated the bunch of us. And he said, and if you lot are filing copy about what she's just said, you need to be ashamed of yourselves because English is not her first language.
Bloody hell. Really?
Yes.
Well, maybe Phil Collins had a relationship with her if it was Princess Michael of Kent, because...
Well, that might be going a bit far.
Well, it might not be because years later... maybe years. No, it could have been, I don't know at the time. I was sent.
Could have been that week.
It might have been that week. I was sent to Mallorca with Tom Smith, a photographer, to find Prince Michael of Kent after newspaper reports of Princess Michael of Kent being on some billionaire's yacht in the Mediterranean, you know? And it was amazing. We eventually found the villa that Prince Michael of Kent was staying in. It was very highly guarded. So I climbed over the fence, literally at the back, ran across the lawn to the swimming pool where Prince Michael of Kent was sunbathing and approached him. And he said, who are you? You know, and I said, I'm really sorry to bother you, sir. I said, I'm Michael Parry from the Daily Express. What are you doing here? Your wife's been spotted on a boat in the Mediterranean with an oil billionaire. You know, do you think she might be having an improper relationship with this man? He said, what? And he went running up into the house. But it was somebody else's house. And he didn't know the way around. And as he ran in the back, I walked towards the front door to make an official knock on the door to enter. But he came running out of that door and bumped into me. I mean, it was hilarious. It was like they keep
so you trespassed for the sake of a story.
I did. I climbed over the fence and went in there. And
you could have got arrested.
I could have got arrested. Tom Smith.
Mind you, we've been arrested a few times.
Well, we have. Yeah, I got arrested in Sardinia. Once on a football trip, but it wasn't football. It was during the World Cup.
We could do a whole podcast on our arrest. We'll do that sometime.
We'll do that some other time. But no, I mean, there's always been rumours about Princess Michael of Kent. Very recently, I think last year she was pictured in London with a chap. You know, I think they have a sort of arrangement. Those two.
She must be a bit past it now.
Well, she still looks very nice, you know, and I think it's a bit But,
with all, you know, the scaffolding on and everything.
Well, see, here we go again, Miss Jones, you know, cattily attacking another female, you know.
Yeah, but once it all comes off, the false eyelashes and the false nails and the hair pieces and all that, and the makeup's all washed off. Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't want to wake up to that in the morning, do you?
Well, you see, once again, I wouldn't make comment like that about a woman. I don't denigrate women. I don't tear them to pieces. Women are beautiful to me, you know, whatever they are. Talking about women, by the way, an old colleague of ours, Amanda Platel, seems to have got married to the former editor of The Observer.
Now, where have you heard this?
I saw it in some column somewhere, you know, some gossip column, said Amanda Platel has tied the knot with, and I can't remember the name of the editor. It wasn't Donald Trelford.
It's Roger Alton.
That's him, Roger Alton. That's a guy, yeah.
He used to be married to Helen Lederer, the comedian.
Did he? Oh, I didn't know that.
Years ago, back in the 80s. Oh, she's mad. I often bump into her because she doesn't live far from me. She's absolutely nuts, yeah. They have a daughter who's a model, actress, kind of whatever, yeah.
Really?
Amanda Platel I used to know quite well because she was married to a guy called John Chenery, who was my commissioning editor at U Magazine.
Oh, right.
And they both Australian. They came over together. They worked, obviously, for the Rupert Murdoch organisation. And made their way to England to sort of expand their repertoire, as it were.
Sure.
She rose and rose, and John kind of vanished without trace. Last heard of living in Costa Rica.
Who was? John?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I know they got divorced because she sometimes, you know, reflects back on her, a bit like your friend Liz Smith. She often makes reference to the failed marriage and all that kind of
stuff. Or Liz Jones, even.
Oh, Liz Jones, yeah.
You're getting your Smith and your Joneses mixed up today.
Yeah, definitely. But no, I like Amanda. I used to meet her in some basement club in Soho. It's not one of yours.
There's a lot of basement clubs in Soho.
Yeah, it's called the Waterloo or something like that. I can't remember now. But we used to go there a lot, and it was down.
The Colony Club, I think.
Was it the Colony? It might have,
yeah, it would have been the Colony.
The Colony was upstairs. Anyway.
No, it's closed now, anyway.
It's closed, yeah. And used to see her there. And we used to see that other lady there, the one who sadly died. You know, she was the foreign correspondent with one eye.
Oh, yes, I know who you mean.
I can't remember her name now, but
yes.
She sadly got blown up in, I think.
Yeah, she worked for The Times. I can't remember her name.
No, I can't, but she was a lovely lady. She used to wear an eye patch because she lost her eye.
Yes, she did.
In an attack in Sri Lanka, I think it was, or Ceylon or somewhere like that. Anyway, there we go.
Isn't that the same place?
Yeah,
I think Sri Lanka and Ceylon.
Yeah, absolutely right. Ceylon is now. Well, you know, these things happen. Anyway, talking about people we've known from our past. Now, what do you make of James Pennell getting the boot from the BBC?
Well, it's probably quite right. I think he was a useless Labour MP, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, yeah.
He goes and gets a job at the Beeb in 2013, and then in comes the new DG, Tim Davey, and off with his head, you know. So now he's going off to the University of the Arts, London, for a new post there. So useless people will continue to rise and rise and be promoted.
Of course they will. They do. The thing is, in the establishment and high society here, there's a gravy train. And people just jump off it and jump on it, and they get pushed off the other side, and they jump on another gravy train. They're all run by their mates. James Pennell is a typical Oxbridge graduate, came out, decided to become an MP, and then when he was no good at being an MP or a minister, he looked for another mate. Oh, look, my mate's running the BBC. I'll get a job there. And they paid him £320,000 to be in charge of radio at the BBC. Well, I've worked in radio 20 years, and he knew about as much about radio as does the bunion on my foot if I had one, but I haven't got any bunions, you know what I mean?
Are you sure?
Yeah, sir. But, I mean, it's absolutely, it annoys me like mad, you know. I've got no problem with people getting on in life, getting good jobs and all that, but at least earn it or have some talent to do the blinking job instead of being given it by your mates. You know, it really does annoy me, I'm telling you.
It's the old school tie thing, isn't it?
And
it shouldn't be the case, especially not in the Labour Party.
No. I totally agree. It's supposed to be social justice and all that kind of stuff, isn't it? Not much social justice around there. Now, this won't particularly inspire you, Miss Jones, but I'm delighted to say that today is the anniversary of Agincourt, okay? Which I think was 1415.
And, it was 1415, very well remembered.
Oh, thank you very much indeed. The Battle of Waterloo, of course, was 1815.
1812, wasn't it?
No, I think it was 18. It could have been 1812. And the Sea Battle, 1805, okay? The one I'm talking about, Trafalgar. Battle of Trafalgar, where Nelson sadly lost his life. But Agincourt was an amazing victory because what happened was the French army was about 10 times the size of our army, but old King Henry V did a very clever thing. He found a field in which he decided the battle would take place, which had the narrowest of entrances from the other side. So when the enemy came to meet the English army, they had to file into this field through a narrow gap between a hill, do you see what I mean, and a forest to get into the field. And the English knew the field was soaking wet. It was a swamp. So as the French army came through and came towards them, the further the horses got into the field, the more they were sinking into the swamp. And eventually, a third of the French army was left standing in mud and couldn't move. And that's when the English archers opened up with their longbows and massacred the French army.
Horrible. Yeah. The French were literally sunk, weren't they?
They were sunk, you're absolutely right, yeah. But it was a great British victory. And that, of course, is where the origin of the V sign comes from, because what the French threatened to do was to cut off the archers' two fingers to draw their bow, so they couldn't use their bow and arrow to fight. And that's where, you know, the V sign, when you throw a V sign at somebody, that's where it comes from.
I see. It's also the origin of Shakespeare's famous play, Henry V.
Yes, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
Written in 1599.
1599, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm, very interesting. That's a long time afterwards, isn't it? But yeah. Anyway, there we are. Military things. I was going to tell you. I'll tell you about that in a minute. No, when I got in last night, right, I got in quite late. I switched on the telly, and for some unknown reason, it was on the Sky Arts channel. But once again, it was a commemorative programme about ABBA. I don't know why, but it was, you know. And the most amazing bit of it, and I think I've seen this before, was the explanation about the Winner Takes It All song, which was written by Benny for Agnetha as they were splitting up so he could say to her, "I understand your pain, the winner takes it all." I mean, you've been through a divorce yourself, and somebody on the show said there's never an easy divorce, but these two actually went into writing songs for each other about it to try and ease their pain.
Well, there was a precedent, of course. We've talked about this before, which was the Rumours album by Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, yes, of course.
Which was all the relationships breaking down at once.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, eminent songwriters I know state that The Winner Takes It All is the greatest, most perfect pop song of all time.
Really? Yeah.
Yes, because it does have such a melody. The lyrics are so striking.
The winner takes it all.
We all relate to that song, don't we?
The loser takes a fall. Yeah.
How did your audition go?
Yeah, how did my audition go? And I tell you what else is stunning about it. The video that accompanied it was Agnetha at her beautiful best. You know, the face etched with misery and hurt of the pain of the divorce. You know what I mean? It was amazing.
I mean, it doesn't get better than Agnetha, does it, really? No. You know, who are you going to get that's any better than her as a female?
Oh, absolutely. She was my dream woman. You know, I couldn't go out with a girl during the ABBA years because if they didn't, you know, rate at least 2 or 3 out of 10 against Agnetha, there was no point in bothering. And I never found one that rated even 1 out of 10 against Agnetha, you know?
No, I heard her talk in an interview some years later, and she said the saddest thing was that Benny and Bjorn forced them on the road all the time.
Yeah.
They weren't allowed to bring their young children.
Oh, that's right. She said a bit of that last night, yeah.
And she was heartbroken to have to leave her kids behind.
Yes.
And this was all for the love of her man, and it was all pointless anyway because he dumped her.
Yeah, yeah, I know. It was tragic. But anyway, there you go. And it, you know, and of course, after that, Benny and Bjorn got together with your friend Tim Rice, and then Chess suddenly emerged and they became superstars all over again, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. Brilliant musical, you know, the famous song from that, One Night in Bangkok.
One Night in Bangkok, yeah.
There you go. Yeah, do remember it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah. No, brilliant, nice. Brilliant musical, yeah.
Yeah, and just to finish on that, the Bono, why do you pronounce his name? Bono.
Bono. It's actually not his real name. His name is Paul, but it's from the Latin Bono Vox, meaning wonderful voice.
Really? Right. Oh, he's not shy about it then, yeah.
I don't think he dubbed himself that. Yeah, I think it was somebody else, yeah.
But anyway, he was interviewed at the end, and Bono said, you know, when ABBA first came on the scene, of course, he said nobody took any notice of them. I didn't realise that after their first hit, Waterloo, it was 18 months before they had another hit because they just didn't get going properly. And then Stig, somebody, became their manager and they took off. But Bono said, once they got going, once we listened to their melodies, he said, we have to accept they're one of the greatest groups of all time. And Bono said something really, really prosaic. He said, the thing is, we dismissed them at first because they weren't making boys' music like everybody else in that era. They were making girls' music, but it was very good girls' music.
Yeah, I suppose there's something in that, but it's a bit sexist, isn't it?
I suppose it is, but it describes the music. I mean, you know, he must have been thinking about Led Zeppelin and all that. That really is sort of heavy metal boys' music, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, we had a girl, when I worked at Chrysalis Records in the early 80s,
yes.
We had a girl there called Heavy Metal Heather, who was into all those. Yeah. I mean, she really was quite a butch person, but she was a lovely girl. She was into all those heavy metal bands, you know. Yeah, she used to clank around the office, dripping in all this metal, literally.
Good God, yeah, straight.
Yeah, tattoos and all that.
Well, whatever turned you on, obviously. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. You know, I'm trying to keep Miss Jones on the straight and narrow here, but every subject that we stray onto, you know, another nefarious tale comes out.
You're blaming me for all this?
I'm not blaming you for it at all, Miss Jones. I know you lead a very nun-like life. We've already talked about nuns being at the top of the charts already in this. Do you know Anna Wintour, the legendary and fearsome editor of Vogue?
Nuclear Winter, as they called her in her offices, Yes, of course, yes. I'm a bit annoyed with her, actually.
Right.
Because she seems to have got together with one of my favourite men on earth, Bill Nighy.
Oh, right. Why is Mr. Nighy, the actor, why is he one of your favourite men on earth?
I've always fancied him.
Really?
I can't really explain why. I mean, look at him. He's a lanky streak of piss, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's,
I was going to say that.
He's about 6'3" or something. Yeah. I've seen him walking around Mayfair and so on. What I really admire about him, he's that rare actor who always plays himself in every single film and manages to get away with it. You couldn't really call it acting because what you're getting is Bill Nighy in every single role.
Yes.
If you take, you know, Billy Mack in Love Actually, he was Davy Jones in Pirates of the Caribbean and so on.
Yeah.
You always know you're getting him, so that's not convincing acting.
Mm.
But somehow or another, people love him for it.
Yeah, but doesn't Hugh Grant do that as well?
Yeah, he does, but I don't like Hugh Grant
for
all the reasons that we've discussed many, many times.
Yeah, we have, but I still think Hugh Grant's a great actor. There's something new starting on Sky tonight with him, and he plays the role of an oncologist, actually, but a very high.
Oh, no. I mean, that kind of chimes with the part he played on television recently, doesn't it?
Well, the last great telly thing he did was a very...
A Jeremy Thorpe thing, talking.
Yeah, a very British affair. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, oncology and that stuff are not a million miles apart, are they?
Miss Jones, you know, can we just not get down to the, you know... The
family show stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the grubbing end of every sentence. I don't know, honestly. It's no wonder
smart, I tell you, smart.
You can take the girl out of Fleet Street, but not the girl out of myself. No, but anyway, what I was going to say was, it looks like Ms. Wintour and Bill Nighy might now be together. But, I mean, did you ever meet Anna Wintour? Did you ever go to the fashion show she was at?
I went to a fashion show in New York Fashion Week, and she was in the front row with her famous black glasses on. You know, she was the first one to do that, which is actually quite wise because... Mm. Those spotlights at the fashion shows are blinding.
Oh, really?
And that was always her look, was the sort of helmet, page boy haircut and the dark glasses and so on. She's very skinny.
Yeah.
And, of course, Meryl Streep sent her up as Miranda Priestley, didn't she?
Oh, absolutely.
In that film called...
The Devil Wears Prada.
Extraordinary film.
Yeah, and I tell you something, though. It would have opened the eyes to a lot of the population who don't know how our world works. So, for instance, the Devil Wears Prada editor, who is based on Anna Wintour, she rings her new PA on a Friday night and says, I'm going to see my children in their school play tomorrow. I have to go down to Florida, get me a flight for so-and-so and so-and-so and this and this and this. So the PA girl spends all the next day, not at work, but at home, trying to arrange these flights, but can't. And all her friends and her boyfriend are saying, what are you doing this for? You're not paid to do this. You work Monday to Friday. And it opened up the eyes of the world to the fact that actually in that sort of environment, in that job, you never stop working, do you?
No, and it's a toxic environment. And of course, the PA eventually worked out that this was a waste of her life.
Yes.
So there was a good resolution to the story.
Well, but, what happened?
Well, she dumped Miranda Priestley and she went off to have a proper life.
Oh, did she? Well, that's not a great ending to a story, is it?
I think it is. Yes, she found herself and she found that this very fake, materialistic world that she was working in was not for her.
There's nothing fake and materialistic about the world we worked in, Miss Jones, you know?
Oh, come on. Magazines were very, well, women's magazines, very, very different place from the hardcore world of newspapers.
Well, I think you're right. I've never worked on a magazine, so I wouldn't know. What makes me laugh? Is that I read the Mail on Sunday every Sunday. Well, I read everything every day anyway. And I look at You magazine, the one in which Liz Jones, that's right, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, that's the one.
Yeah, same name as you. I've just realised that, actually.
time, yeah. Virtually the same name. Did I tell you what she said to me at the Christmas party at the Mail on Sunday?
No, what?
Christmas just gone. We hadn't seen each other for years.
Yeah.
I didn't know she'd remember me. She was talking to Louise Gannon, a friend of mine.
Oh, I know, Louise.
So I wandered up and... That's right. At a moment of lull in the conversation, I introduced myself. And Liz said, oh, you're Leslie Ann Jones. She said, you're the one I always blame whenever I write something about a musician and I get it slightly wrong. Ooh. I always say that it was you who did it and not me.
Right.
And we burst out laughing and became the best of friends.
Very
instantly.
Good. Excellent. But when I look at that magazine, and it's a class publication, it's printed on very nice paper and all that kind of stuff. The pictures are always excellent and all that. But if you look at the list of people who work on it, there's about 50 of them. I mean, you know, style director, assistant style director, assistant to the assistant style director. I mean, that's the way women's magazines work, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's a bit lipstick and tights these days, I have to say. When I worked there, it gave the Sunday Times magazine a run for its money, and it won Magazine of the Year award 3 times in a row under Nick Gordon, who was our editor. Mm-hmm. And we were covering proper stories.
Yeah.
The elephant crisis in Africa and the gorilla crisis in Rwanda. Yeah. I was sent to South Dakota once to interview a boy who had his arms torn off in a threshing machine and managed to crawl half a mile to a telephone and dial the number with his mouth.
I remember that story, actually.
Yeah, John Thompson, his name was. Yeah. I wonder whatever happened to him. Yeah. But amazing stories. We covered proper... The brief was ordinary people doing extraordinary things and extraordinary people doing ordinary things.
Yes, yes.
Exactly. And that's a great Fleet Street brief, isn't it?
That's right. In fact, that's almost the brief for the film Crocodile Dundee, isn't it? When Linda Kowalski flies out to, you know, the Northern Territories to find this man who kills crocodiles.
Yeah.
You don't sound impressed.
Crocodile Dundee wasn't really my cup of tea.
Oh, it was great. I just thought it was a brilliant laugh, you know, and they put it well together. Now, talking about assignments and all that, and you just talked about that extraordinary story you just told me about. It's also the anniversary this week, believe it or not, of the United States invading Grenada, okay, as the Americans call it. I think we call it Grenada, don't we?
No, we don't. Grenada's in Spain.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. So we call it
Grenada in the Caribbean. Has always been known as Grenada.
Yeah, Grenada, okay, yeah. So,
and there used to be a television rental company called Grenada, if you remember, on the high street years ago.
Well, not only a television rental company, they were in fact the studios where Coronation Street was made for 30 years in Manchester.
Oh, that's right, yes.
In those days, Lou Grade ran the Midland TV franchise, ITV. Grenada had the Northwest one. There was Yorkshire Television, there was Scottish Television. It's all ITV now, but they used to be each individual companies, and they were amazingly profitable. In fact, Lou Grade said, you know, if you want a license to print money, buy yourself a TV franchise. But anyway, there we are. So anyway, it was my first stint out in America. I was very young. I was delighted to have got the job. And the first thing I was told to do when I got there was go to Grenada, because the Americans had invaded it. Anyway, you couldn't get a grenade, and the Americans made that certain. So we were all holed up in Barbados. So, you know, you can say, tough life, eh? Holed up in the Sandy Lanes Hotel in Barbados. But as you well know, Miss Jones, if anybody had pulled one over on me and got a great line on the story, it would have been curtains for me as a new boy, you see. So I had to be constantly on the alert. But the funniest thing was, I learnt then for the first time the sort of camaraderie of the foreign correspondent. There was a guy who worked for the Telegraph called Henry Miller, right? But and he worked for the Telegraph in New York, and he'd been sent down. But we all knew him as Harry, right? Harry Miller. And Harry had a bit of a drink problem, to say the least, if you know what I mean.
It's not the same Harry Miller who was the sports writer.
No, definitely not. No, Harry didn't know anything about sports. So,
drinking's a sport.
Well, it certainly was a sport for Harry. If he wasn't sent out of New York on a story somewhere, he spent all his time on a bar on a bar stool in Costello's, literally, you know. But Harry got down there. He was already pissed when he arrived and was just completely out of it. So each evening, about 5 o'clock London time, we took it in turns to file for Harry to the Telegraph news desk in London our own story. And that went on all week. Harry never filed a word, but he got a story in every day in the Telegraph under his own name.
Brilliant. And what was in it for you?
Nothing. It was just the camaraderie, you know, said we've got to help Harry out. You know, we're all a band of brothers over here and that's what we have to do. But Harry was so out of it, he didn't know where he was. He didn't even know he was in Barbados, you know what I mean?
Oh, dear.
The sad end to that story was that it was about a year later. He suddenly got a note to, pop back to London and have a chat and all that. And they just fired him just like that because he'd just become a horrible perpetual drunk. And Harry was last heard of driving a taxi on Long Island. Although how he could ever drive in the sort of state he got himself into, I don't know. But one of those sad stories. The other guy who I remember making a dreadful mess of things was Bob Smith. Do you remember Bob?
No.
Well, Bob Smith ran the...
You sure he wasn't called Bob Jones?
No, that's a good question. No, his name is definitely Bob Smith. And Bob ran the Star office, Rupert Star magazine, okay, when, for the benefit of our listeners, when Rupert Murdoch arrived in America, bought the New York Post, then he decided to compete with the National Enquirer and opened the Star magazine, okay? And they had a big West Coast bureau, and Bob, who was a Scotsman, was head of that. Anyway, on a visit to New York, you know, to see the troops in New York, the New York office where it was based, along with the rest of Murdoch's empire, suddenly Mark Thatcher turned up in Fort Worth, Dallas, when he was supposed to be romancing the daughter of a secondhand car salesman from Fort Worth.
Diane Sawyer, wasn't it?
Oh, was that her? Oh, that's her. Yeah. Great movie. Yeah, fantastic. And so Bob decided to go himself. So we all got a plane, American Airlines, down to Fort Worth, Dallas. And Bob missed the plane because he got drunk in the airport. He got drunk at LaGuardia. So he came about 2 hours later. And then when he arrived, he was absolutely smashed, right? And so we were trying to keep a low profile in this restaurant that they were supposed to be dining in that night. And we went to the restaurant. And the only other people in the restaurant were other Fleet Street journalists who had come by a different route to Fort Worth, Dallas, you see. And we were all waiting for Mark Thatcher and this lady, Diane Sawyer, to walk in. And we were all keeping a low profile. All of a sudden, the door bursts open. In comes Bob Smith in a white suit, right, with a young lady of questionable virtue on his arm. He booked into the hotel in Dallas, and he picked up a packet of matches out of the bowl that they used to leave the matches in on the front desk, you know. And as he opened flicked open the packet of matches, there was the number for a prostitute written on the inside of it. That's how they used to acquire business in hotels.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So Bob got up to his room, rang the number, had a sort of liaison with this lady, and then for some bizarre reason decided to invite her to the restaurant where we were all supposed to be, you know, doing this undercover work, trying to track down Mark Thatcher. So I'm afraid it wasn't Bob's most glorious trip.
And you've never done anything like that yourself, of course.
Well, yeah, one time I remember I went, this wasn't really my fault because it was on a Friday afternoon And most Friday afternoons in New York, you were allowed to go out on the lash about 1 o'clock because it was 6 o'clock in London. The paper was away, no problem. But suddenly at 7 o'clock, the New York Times, somebody in England where it was midnight, had this mad idea that I should get onto the Bill Clinton campaign trail because it was coming close to the election. And I'd been warning them for weeks that Bill Clinton, and it wasn't Bill Clinton, I'm sorry. It was the Reagan election. So it was some guy who was a lawyer who was standing for the Democrats. Sorry, anyway, long story. But anyway, I said, okay. I was terribly pissed. I went out to LaGuardia to get the flight and I went to the wrong state. I can't remember the name of the town now, but as you know, in America, there's towns of the same name all over the place. There's about six Birminghams, for instance. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I went to the airport, fixed up a ticket, got on the plane and flew to Ohio, right, which is about 600 miles north. And when I got there, I got into a taxi, said to this guy, take me to the Hilton Hotel, please. He said, there isn't a Hilton Hotel in this town. I said, there certainly is. I said, I've got a booking form here, look. And I showed him, I said, there's the address. He said, sir, that is the Hilton Hotel in Georgia, which is about 1,000 miles south. Seriously.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I mean, talk about embarrassed. Thank God we didn't have mobile phones in those days because the office would have been able to track me where I was, you know what I mean? But I had no option but to stay over the night in Ohio and then get the first flight the next morning, not just back to New York, but all the way down to Georgia, which, as you know, is a long way down in the deep south. But anyway, these things happen. I don't know why I'm rambling on about that.
No, I don't either. But how did your expenses claim go that month?
Well, luckily, you had, even in those days, a long time ago, you had bits of plastic and it just all went on the plastic. And then, you know, months later, somebody would ring you up and say, what was this flight here there for? And you said, oh, I couldn't remember and all this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? So yeah. That's where it always went. Anyway, I'm rambling now and I shouldn't be rambling. I don't know why. But listen, do you know Phil Daniels?
I have met him.
Yeah.
You mean Jimmy Cooper in Quadrophenia, I think.
That's a guy. He drove a Beretta scooter, didn't he? Wasn't he a mod?
Yeah, he did. Kind of stuff. Over the side in the end, didn't he?
Oh, did he? Oh, really? Yeah, I don't know. But I just wanted to know, because he's a pretty popular character. But look, talking about popular characters, Lewis Hamilton has achieved a remarkable record. He's now won more Grand Prix than anybody in the history of motor racing. He's overtaken Michael Schumacher and got 92. And do you know what? The reaction from people in this country is extremely lukewarm. Can you put your finger on why the general sporting population in this country doesn't warm all that much to Lewis Hamilton?
Well, it is interesting. My friend Jonathan McAvoy has written a great piece in the Daily Mail about it.
Right.
The fact that we don't really like Lewis Hamilton. He seems to have rubbed us up the wrong way as a nation.
Ooh.
I think part of it was when he got on the eco bandwagon and we all thought, hang on a minute, these racing cars burn how much fuel as they hurtle around the tracks and, you know, put how much poison into the atmosphere. And it all seemed a little bit holier than thou. And he's, I think we find him quite arrogant and pompous.
Well, yeah, but then I can't quite understand it. I admire anybody who's a winner and people who dedicate themselves to their craft like he does and get to the top. He's a bit like Ronaldo. The reason Ronaldo is the greatest footballer in the world and will be one of the greatest ever is because every second of his living day is focused on how to improve himself as a person, as a footballer, and how to not do things that would, work against him as a footballer. He practices more than other people. He eats better than other people, all this kind of stuff. And Hamilton does the same in motor racing. There's something about, I'm not sure what it is, something about the fact that he doesn't smile enough, I think.
Well, do you know what I think it is? You've just hit the nail on the head by comparing him to Ronaldo.
Right.
There's no humility at all.
Yeah, could be. It could be. It could be the fact there's no humility. But the other thing is, he lives in Monaco, right? So that means he lives there for tax reasons. Who can blame him? You know, if you're liable to tax bills of 10 or 15 million pounds a year, I don't blame anybody for going and finding a better tax regime. And by the way, he's not the only one who does it. Lots of businessmen do it. And funny enough, I saw David Coulthard, another racing driver who was quite successful. He's never world champion, but he won a lot of Grand Prix. I saw him on the box this morning talking about Lewis Hamilton, and he lives in Monaco and did all through his career. But David is a smiling, happy, avuncular Scotsman. You know what I mean?
There you go. And so Lewis does nothing to redeem himself, does he really? But You know, is it really right that while the rest of us are back here slaving away and parting with huge chunks of our income to the Treasury, that it's all right for somebody like Lewis Hamilton to go and live in a tax haven?
Well, ask yourself, what would you do?
I don't think I would do it because I'm British and my duty here is to Queen and country and I have to contribute to the HMRC.
Yeah, I would agree with that, frankly. I love living in Britain. I found it difficult living in America and I lived there for 3.5 years. You know, I miss so many things about Britain. You can still come back for 90 days, even if you're a tax exile, but I would want to plant myself in Britain. I agree with you and I would pay the taxes. I don't think we've got an over-punitive tax regime in this country now.
Not at the moment. No, we don't have.
Hopefully it won't, you know, impinge upon us because of the pandemic bills and all that kind of stuff. But no, I don't know why the country's never really worn to him. You know, winners.
Well, it's obviously for that reason, I think. Yeah. You know, if he were to move back here and buy his nice big house here and pay his tax here, I think we'd find him one of us.
Yes, no, I think you're probably right. Now, Ms. Jones, what do you think about, because this could affect you very shortly, it may affect you already, what do you think about the boomerang generation problem? This is children, you know, about the same age that your children are, who simply just can't get off and get a start in life, and even in their early 30s, end up back at home. Would you welcome that, or would you think it was going to be a hazard to the development of your offsprings?
Well, I'm right in that boat, of course, because I've got all three of mine at home.
Right.
My eldest daughter is working for Island Records and she's doing very well there. She is living with me. My younger two, who both graduated this summer, not that they got their graduation ceremonies, but they graduated.
Oh, but you gave them a graduation ceremony. We've talked about it.
Yeah, we have one in the garden. Yeah. They'll have one at college eventually, but they're both living at home. One is working as an assistant manager of the local pub while the West End is shut down, so he can't appear in any shows.
Shocking.
And the other one is working as a classroom assistant.
Right.
You know, they are out there bringing in work, doing what they can.
Yeah.
When they're able to, of course they want to have their own places to live. They don't really want to live with their old mum, but for now, it's an arrangement that suits everybody, isn't it?
Yeah, well, of course it is, yeah. But, I do worry about it. I mean, I'm older than you, but I was very lucky to be able to buy, I've told this story many times, I bought my first house for £20,000 when I was earning £12,000 a year on the Daily Express. Do you imagine saying to a young person these days, oh, go and get yourself a house for less than twice your salary? I mean, crikey, you'd have to earn about £200,000 a year at the age of about 24.
They need to fix this because at the moment, the property ladder is not accessible to most young people.
That's right.
Unless you can borrow 50 grand from your parents to put down as a deposit. And I think even now they can only borrow 2 or 3 times their salary, can't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not going to buy you very much.
Not going to buy you much. And funny enough, my niece is in that very same position. Now, she's done extremely well. She's a chartered surveyor, right? And she works with, you know, one of the big sort of land and property agents in London. And she's in the process of buying an apartment, but we had to find £75,000 as a deposit. And that still leaves her with a mortgage of £550,000. And, you know, it's incredible numbers. How many people can actually achieve that? I have to say she's in her early 30s, so it's not like, you know, she's just come out of university or anything, but she's had to wait 10 years to get it all together. And that seems to be the fate of many people of her generation.
Yeah, it does. And it's horrible to think of them throwing all their hard-earned cash away on rent.
Yes, indeed. I totally agree. Now, let me tell you something else, Ms. Jones. I read a wonderful piece over the weekend about a lady, and I've forgotten her name now, but it was one of these day-in-the-life things, you know what I mean? And her job is CEO of Abbey Road Studios. She's the chief executive officer of Abbey Road Studios. Imagine going to work every day by crossing the famous zebra, which she does, the zebra crossing, okay? And imagine walking into the building where all the Beatles records were made and that's your office. How about
I can't remember her name. I have met her. I've been many times into
Abbey Road Studios. Isabel Garvey.
Okay, she's blonde, isn't she?
Yes, she is, yes.
Yes, she's a lovely, lovely person.
Yeah.
And I did many things in Abbey Road over the years. Yes, it's almost like a church. Of course, it was called EMI Studios during the Beatles' time there.
Yes, that's right.
And they renamed the studios in honor of that.
Exactly, in honor of that LP.
Disputed final album, because there's a huge argument that's raged for years as to whether Abbey Road or Let It Be was the last album, of course.
Well, but Let It Be came out last, but...
Abbey Road is the sign off, really? Yeah. Because there's even the track on it called The End.
That's right.
But yeah, it's an extraordinary place. It is like a church. It's the walls in there are heaving with you know, past albums and spirit, and there's so much there. The Beatles pianos, those old wooden microphones are there.
Golly.
And of course there's that vast Studio 2 there where they can fit an entire orchestra in there to record them live and so on. There's a lot of ghosts in that place.
I bet there are. I bet a lot of ghosts. I'm gonna make a point of trying to get there one day. I must do before I die. Seriously.
See, you can't go in. Members of the public, it's not like, say, Hansa Ton Studios in Berlin, for example, you can tour.
Yeah.
And Queen's old studios in Montreux, you can go there. It's like a museum experience there now.
Yeah.
But unless you have a professional reason to be in Abbey Road, you can't just go in there.
Golly. She says, oh, it's quite interesting, really. She said, pandemic has hit us, she said, because I'm used to wandering around the building and bumping into people like Paul McCartney and Noel Gallagher, but I haven't seen them for months.
But you can do it. There's an online tour, I think, you can do of Abbey Road. Yeah, well, it's worth having a look at.
Let's start with that. Right, okay, Miss Jones, well, thank you very much indeed. I know you've got a busy day ahead of you, so best of luck in all your endeavours.
Thank you very much.
And to our listeners, thank you very much indeed again for joining us, and we'll be back with you again very soon.
So we will.
Have you ever thought about being a nun, Miss Jones?
I actually haven't, strangely enough.
Really?
No, I've never,
You led such a, a clean life and attended church every Sunday morning. I thought it might have been one of your career options when you were growing up.
I don't think it was, actually. I think I had too many other things on the go.
I think the sort of behaviour you indulged in during your sort of teenage and early 20 years prohibited you from becoming non-material, in my view, Miss Jones.
Are you trying to say I was louche?
No, not at all. But, you know, anybody who drinks 2 gallons of wine a day and frequents the sort of haunts that you used to go to with the reckless pop stars and all that kind of stuff, not exactly the life inside a nunnery. He plays the role of an oncologist, actually, but a very high...
that kind of chimes with the part he played on television recently, doesn't it?
The last great telly thing he did was a very...
A Jeremy Thorpe thing, talking.
Yeah, a very British affair. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, oncology and that stuff are not a million miles apart, are they?
Miss Jones, can we just not get down to the, the
family show stuff?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the grubby end of every sentence. I don't know, honestly. It's no wonder
smut.
You can take the girl out of Fleet Street, but not the girl out of myself. You mustn't talk ill of the dead, obviously, but I mean, he
Well, we can.
Yes, we can, I suppose, yeah.